nice to be here again. I can feel you sitting while I'm sitting. It's really nice. It's hardly any space between us at all. I hope you're all well. We're on chapter 22, which is a very short chapter, but has plenty to consider as part of this continual unwrapping of what's really true, what's real. You begin to think, like my friend always said, this is my hand. This is real. This is all there is. And then, as she became very, very old and very much going away, she began to realize that it wasn't just her hand, that there was a great deal bigger than this. We say emptiness, but that's a kind of feeble word for something very big and very close to us. So close that we can't see. It's like I'm trying to see itself. So this chapter is about another question to Subhuti from the Buddha. And by this time, Subhuti is giving all the right answers. So in the first half, he's always saying, you know, gosh, I don't know. Or saying things that an arhat would say, but not a bodhisattva. But now he's saying, he's giving bodhisattva kinds of answers. And so Buddha is very encouraging to him and giving him more. Would somebody like to read this? It's only three paragraphs, three small paragraphs.
And it's chapter 22, is that right, Angie?
Yes, chapter 22. Brenda, I can't see you.
That's on purpose.
Are you hiding?
I am. Here, let's see. There, here I am from the side. So, so I found it. I can read. Chapter 22. Subhuti, what do you think? Did the Tathagata realize any such dharma as unexcelled perfect enlightenment? The Venerable Subhuti replied, no, indeed, Bhagavan, the Tathagata did not realize any such dharma, Bhagavan, as unexcelled, perfect enlightenment. The Buddha said, so it is, Subhuti, so it is. The slightest dharma is neither obtained nor found therein. Thus is it called unexcelled, perfect enlightenment.
So once more, we have a negative and a positive, both given to us in the same sentence. No, indeed, yes, indeed. No, it's not, yes, it is. How can I possibly understand such a thing? This is called by, I always forget his name. Chao Ming called no dharma to realize. And that really tells it. We posit dharma as we posit everything that we experience. We give everything a name. And with the name comes a sense of permanent reality. Even though intellectually we know that nothing is permanent and everything is in the way of falling apart or being built up to fall apart. So Buddha is pointing over and over to the impermanent aspect of everything, the unreality of our convictions that everything has to be fixed, that there is some fixed truth that we can hold on to, when in fact there's nothing to hold. And that holding itself is the source of our suffering. As soon as we begin to cling, our suffering begins. Red Pine says, in the previous chapters, the Buddha examined the nature of his reward and aberration bodies. The reward body is Sambhogakaya, and the aberration body is the Nirmanakaya, the teaching. And then he's talking about perfect enlightenment. Enlightenment itself, which is Buddha's real body. You could say it's the whole catastrophe. Somebody once said, the Buddha has already told us that when he was the ascetic Sunnita, he did not obtain any such dharma from Vipassana. If you remember that part of this. He gained an acceptance of the birthlessness of all dharmas at that point. And that was what got him on the road. Once you can accept that the utter impermanence and birthlessness of all things, it doesn't mean you throw your life away or you throw life away or any part of life, but that you embrace each thing as it happens without holding on to, being willing to let it go when it's time for it to go. But this brings up a question. If there is no dharma that can be discovered, then how do we cultivate dharmas? How do we cultivate our practice? And what we end up with was a dharma of equality, of complete equality. So that as Thich Nhat Hanh says in a wonderful image, in our thoughts, the moon may be full or new, bright or dim, present or not present, but the moon itself has none of those characteristics. The moon is just the moon. So our tendency to give value to things and turn things around and make them one thing or another gives us a false sense of solidity. And yet, it's not necessary if we understand that whatever we think, there are many more aspects to what we're thinking about than we can ever possibly even know. And each thought that we have is impermanent. So that the preciousness of our experience is also very poignant, because it doesn't stay. It cannot stay. So with this Red Pine says, realizing the teaching is in your own home. You realize it's never lost, but you can't find it. If you feel like you find it, you're still stuck on attachment, deluded about subject and object. So that gets us back to the self, other, the whole dichotomy that our brain is so good at doing. It's this, that, and me, and it. It's the way that we think, and yet the image they use is that there's a jewel sewn into our coat. And all the time we're looking for this jewel, thinking it's out there. It's already, we're already at home in it. And it's already home of us. Our secret brings us round to sitting eventually. Because although we can't know such a thing, we can experience it in Zazen. And so this knowledge that Tathagata is talking about, the slightest dharma is neither obtained nor found. Thus it's called unexcelled perfect enlightenment. Once it can be, the thought of realization disappears, that's enlightenment itself. It's frustrating in a way. It doesn't mean we don't practice. It means we just allow the whole thing to take care of itself as we practice. It's like what Coben told Blanche. Now the Dharma will take care of itself. If we allow ourselves to truly give ourselves to meditation, then we've already we're already there. Yang said the Buddha says that he does not actually have any thought of seeking or obtaining enlightenment. And because of this, it can be called unexcelled perfect enlightenment. Our wonderful nature is essentially empty, and there is not a single dharma to be found. How could there be any enlightenment to realize? The Buddha found nothing and realized nothing. Since it had no name that he could name, he reluctantly called it unexcelled perfect enlightenment. Since it had no name he could name, he called it unexcelled perfect enlightenment. Yen Ping, he quotes, saying, when the Dharma can be found, it is called Dharma bondage. Only when no Dharma can be found, is it called liberation. Tao Chuan said, looking for someone else isn't as good as looking for yourself. So ultimately, this is our story. Only our story. That's why Yinang was so moved by this when he heard it. realize, oh, there's something here about me. And there's something here to do. Or to not do. There's one more thing of red pine to share with you. When the Buddha realized the Dharma body of unexcelled perfect enlightenment, he not only did not find the greatest of dharmas, he did not find the slightest, most insignificant dharmas. He did not find even an atom of reality. But what is devoid of even an atom of reality is reality itself, which is the Buddha's Dharma body. The awareness of this is what the Buddha means by unexcelled perfect enlightenment. So it's not something that we can figure out, but to expose ourselves to this material and to how it means for us is something that helps us along, even though it's not something you can write home about. The last thing, quote, is this little gatha, planting rice sprouts into rice fields, I look down and see the sky in the water. Purifying the senses is the way, after all. Walking backward turns out to be forward, because planting rice sprouts, you walk backward and put them in one by one. Thus, in cultivating and seeking the way, one moves backward, not forward. Going forward means thinking about finding something. You can imagine how hard this is to say something about. Open the book every week and I think, now how am I going to talk about this unthinkableness that is so keen and deep and true, and how fortunate that people have been brave enough to plunge into it, people like Thich Nhat Hanh and Wee Nang. And there are many others. Sorry about that. Oh, granddaughter. Sophie. So Thich Nhat Hanh. So I'll call you back. Okay. Got a little domestic flavor there. So Thich Nhat Hanh calls this, the moon is just moon. And we then call this something entirely different, it sounds like. He calls it purifying the mind and doing good. It's odd, isn't it? Unkuk transmission calls it, the practice of good works purifies the mind. So one by one, the Buddha has divested Subhuti and his fellow disciples of any delusions or attachments they might have had concerning such a path. In the previous chapter, the Buddha put an end to the perception that Buddhas teach anything. He now puts an end to the perception that Buddhas realize anything. And next, there's another one coming up next that we'll talk about next week, which is about the nature of the Tathagata itself. So this is getting down to brass tacks. This is getting down to talking about the realization of enlightenment and what actually happened to Shakyamuni Buddha. His experience as a previous bodhisattva many, many eons before he sat under the tree, and then all the stories that came through time about practice, his practice, its practice, our practice, how we've been practicing this for so long. Up to the time when he left home and sat beneath the tree. And although it often sounds like he achieved something or attained something, it was not that at all. That's what Buddha is talking about. It was the opposite. It's what Koban always called stepping down. Or as that poem said, in going backward. So that there's room for the whole of it as well as the limitation part of it. We get so in love with the limitation that we lose the view of the bigness of it, the infiniteness, the hugeness of our own nature, which is Buddha's nature. So slowly, slowly, this mysterious document called the Sutra keeps leading us to divest ourselves of the thinking that holds on. Agreeing that we do it, because that's how our mind works. But reminding us there's more. There's a jewel sewn into our clothes. It's our home. Frustrating. There's no Dharma to realize. Darn. There should be something. Get something out of this. Are there questions? Comments? Ron, are you still reading this in the other edition, the Wong Price edition?
Well, not at the moment. just to have a book. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll have to look up sometimes the translations are a little different. I'll have to take it. But I haven't been reading it. I haven't been doing much besides working for a couple of months. So did he examine all of these dharmas?
I didn't hear that last.
Or did he just let them all go, or just somehow put himself in a place where he stepped far enough back that he saw them?
Well, it's always so interesting to read other versions of the translations. And just as a way to realize that none of it is cast in bronze. So even the Diamond Sutra is undependable in one way. As we take it in and make it our own. But each translator has her or his own version of how it's to be. So it's helpful to read in free translation. The Red Pine has done a fabulous job, I think, with this. And given us so many different points of view for eons of great, brilliant teachers.
So my question was, what did the Buddha do? Did he examine all these dharmas, or did he forget about all these dharmas, or did he maybe just step far enough back that he saw them all? There's different ways of...
Rob, the microphone may not be picking
up. Oh, I don't know if she can hear me. Well, yeah, she heard one thing that I said. Can you hear me?
Just a little bit.
Oh, okay. Well, so my question was, did the Buddha examine all these dharmas, or forget about all these dharmas, or maybe just step far enough back that he saw them all?
Well, if you remember what Palm City is like, you begin with your mind full of ideas, dharmas. Dharmas in the small d sense of things, and dharmas in the big d sense of truths, aspects of truth. And in Sesshin, when you begin a retreat, often, almost always, one begins with a pretty good sense of who they are and where they're going. And if they keep faith with practice and just continue, all those begin to, you begin to see through them. They're just thoughts, just infinite numbers of thoughts that keep rising and disappearing and rising and disappearing. And you begin to realize that the Dharma, so-called, are just more thoughts. It's all thinking. And as long as we're thinking, we get in the way of our vision. It's that first eye, we see things. But the eye of wisdom can't see while we're caught up with the vision of things. And so sitting helps us to drop away the barriers to other views. Helps us to drop off our fixed identity and let the truth of ourself and our world begin to penetrate. It's why Sesshin is scary. It's why we aren't wildly enthusiastic about going to Sesshin very often, because it challenges our identity and our certainties. If we remember then we remember that it's not a thing, but it's an experience. And the experience itself is inconceivable in thought and word. On Facebook the other day, I saw somebody put up a set of pictures, maybe some of you saw it, of faces, portraits, just like this, of faces before and after 16. And they were the same face exactly. But before, they all looked tense. Not really worried, but just you could feel the tension in their look. And afterwards, it was so relaxed and always a smile. They were all smiling and had completely dropped off all that stuff. Of course, it doesn't last because we don't keep sitting. But it points to a truth and a reality that Diamond Sutra is pointing to. That what we are is something more than we know or think. More than we can know or think. We can experience it.
Yes, there's a koan. There's a koan. What was my face before I was born?
Yes.
Something like that.
Yeah. That's how big we are. Well, it's 8 o'clock. It goes fast. Well, let's have our 1 minute sit.